Well, I didn't make an audio tape of class 27, our first class together, but I thought I would at least talk a little bit about what we talked about after the fact. So the main result from previous class was what's called the spin statistics theorem. And it's probably one of the truest things that are in our textbook. That is to say, our textbook mostly has to do with non-relativistic particle quantum mechanics, and one can go on to relativistic quantum mechanics, one can go on to relativistic quantum fields. And the spin statistics theorem is true throughout all of that. So it's actually a consequence that can be proved in the context of relativistic quantum field theory. And what the spin statistics theorem says is that if you have a wave function that involves n identical particles, and it may involve other things too, if the particles are fermions, and those are things that have spin 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, we call those, oddly enough, half integers, even though one is a half integer, right? It's half of two. But so fermions, spin 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, if your identical particles are fermions and you exchange the coordinates of any two particles, the wave function has to switch signs. In the case of bosons, so those are things that have integer spin, 0, 1, 2, 3, then if you exchange two particles, the wave function has to have exactly the same sign. So spin statistics theorem is kind of a grown-up version of the Pauli exclusion principle. So the Pauli exclusion principle, as somebody told you in modern or in high school, says approximately that you can't put two electrons into exactly the same state. And as I say, the spin statistics theorem tells you basically the same thing, that try and put two electrons in the same state, you're going to get zero. Now this kind of leads us to a couple of problems. And the first problem is that if we're talking about spin, and if we're talking about anything like a real example, then pretty quickly we're going to have actual three-dimensional space. We're going to have an R vector as opposed to just a single-dimension X location. I mean, you really can't have spin in just one dimension. And typically you're going to have lots of particles. And so the integrals that you're going to have are going to be a three-dimensional integral for each particle. So you might have a six-dimensional integral to do or a nine-dimensional integral to do, and it quickly becomes pretty complicated. So a lot of what we're going to do is going to be restricted to the very simple case of a one-dimensional square well, where it's not really exactly applicable, but we can at least still talk about being even or odd under exchange in the context of a one-dimensional problem. The other pedagogical problem is that the case of identical particles is not all that interesting if they're not in fact interacting particles. So if we have non-interacting identical particles, then the Hamiltonian is just going to be the sum of exactly the same Hamiltonian for each particle separately, and the energies that you would get would just be the sum of the energies as those involved. And the fact that the wave function needs to be anisymmetric under exchange would be pretty well hidden. It wouldn't be at all present in the actual energies of the system. So if we try and do multiple interacting identical particles, then it quickly becomes complicated. And the way that is typically handled is by what's called perturbation theory, and perturbation theory is really the topic of the next chapter. So when we're talking about interacting identical particles, we'll have to do a little bit of hand-waving to say how the spin statistics theorem is actually going to affect the energy that's involved. And we'll justify some of that in the next chapter. So one thing that might be useful to remember is, in the case of non-interacting identical particles, Which, as I say, is not particularly realistic or interesting, but it's at least solvable. Under those circumstances, the Hamiltonian for particle 1 would be exactly the same as the Hamiltonian for particle 2, 3, 4, etc. And the overall energy would just be the sum of those energies. For any one of those Hamiltonians, at least theoretically, we can solve the Eigen problem, and we can find the wave functions and energies so that H psi equals E psi. And if we want to make an anisymmetric wave function that has an energy that is some particular combination of the eigenenergies, you know, say the first and the 17th and the 21st, we can do that with what's called the Slater determinant. That is to say, we can make something that is anisymmetric under exchange by putting the different functions in the first row with the same arguments, and putting those same functions in the second row with the next argument, etc. And probably want to look at the notes to see exactly what that looks like. So if you do that process, you can make a function automatically that's anisymmetric and therefore would actually be allowed. And of course it will have, in this non-interacting case, the energy that's just the sum of the energies that you picked. And so it would look a whole lot like, well, it's hard to see exactly what the difference would be if it were a boson or a fermion. The only kind of noticeable difference is that some states would be disallowed for, say, electrons. If you tried to put two particles in the same state, Pauli exclusion slash spin statistics theorem says it's impossible. So there would be no corresponding wave function. And if you try and do it with the Slater determinant, in fact, the Slater determinant will give you zero if you're using the same same row or column in your determinant. Okay, so in order to kind of have some hand-waving argument about how the energies change if we have symmetric or anisymmetric states, we want to prove a statement. A proof is an overstatement because there's not kind of a generic proof for it. We want to prove the statement that's on page 209 of the textbook that says that identical bosons tend to be somewhat closer together and identical fermions tend to be somewhat further apart than distinguishable particles in the same state. So distinguishable particles means that none of this fancy symmetrization or anti-symmetrization. Just put psi of the first wave function, phi with the first eigenenergy with the first coordinate, and psi with the second eigenenergy with the second coordinate, etc. In contrast to making symmetric or anti-symmetric results. So it's kind of a messy theorem to prove, and I'm not going to prove it, but I do recommend you take a look at it. And the upshot was exactly what the words say. If we have a fully symmetric spatial state, the particles tend to be closer together than if we have a fully anti-symmetric spatial state. And that should make some sense, right? Because if something is fully anti-symmetric, that would mean that if that psi of x1, x2 has to equal minus psi of x2, x1. So if I put in, say, q for both x1 or x2, it says that psi of qq has to be minus psi of qq. And a little bit of algebra tells you that 2 psi of qq has to be 0, so psi of q has to be 0. So antisymmetric wave functions have to be 0 if you ask what's the probability that two of the particles are at exactly the same location and have exactly the same spin. And so if it's zero in exactly the region of x1 equals x2, its continuity tells you it's going to have to be nearly zero in the area around that. So instead of doing that, what I opted to do is take a look at the case of two particles in a infinite square well and just do the various integrals that are involved. So we have the simple product state and I'm going to be concerned about the n equals 2 state for x1 and the n equals 3 state for x2. Make the simple product state that is just the 2-3 combination, make the symmetric state where I connect them with a minus sign and the anisymmetric state, and simply calculate what the expectation value is of the separation between the two particles. So separation would be, in one dimension, would be x1 minus x2. And we're going to square that so we get something that is uniformly positive and take the average value of it. So we're getting something like the RMS distance as a result. And it's a complicated enough problem that it's good for Mathematica, and I've given you the code for it. And what we find is that, in fact, for the distinguishable particles, if we compare the distinguishable particles to the spatially symmetric and the spatially anisymmetric possibilities, roughly speaking, the Bose possibility, the symmetric possibility, is twice as concentrated as the distinguishable case, and the anisymmetric case is quite noticeably further apart, larger values of the separation than you would get otherwise. So those things are clearer if you make the contour plots. And you might remember in class we couldn't make the contour plots because Mathematica wasn't organized properly. But if you make the contour plots, what you find is exactly what you would expect. For the anisymmetric possibility, there is no chance of being at x equals y. The concentrated probability occurs when x1 and x2 are radically different, like 0.2 and 0.8. On the other hand, for the symmetric states, we get big probabilities when x1 equals x2, like 0.2 or 0.8, both of them equaling 0.2 or both of them equaling 0.8. And in the distinguishable particles case, they're not paying any attention at all to each other. That is to say, we see three blobs in the x2 direction and two blobs in the x1 direction, and there doesn't seem to be any particular concern about the possibility that they're in the same place. Okay, so to kind of get where we want to get to with Bose-Fermi statistics, and in particular with symmetry and antisymmetry under particle exchange, we really need to kind of have some idea of how the interaction is going to work, because it's really interacting multiple identical particles that are of greater interest in physics. And in particular, we're going to be concerned about electrons. And while electrons are electrostatically attracted to the nucleus, since they have opposite charges, they're repelled by each other. So as you try and push them together, you're pushing them uphill. It's a lot of positive energy to push them together, the electrostatic repulsion. And the electrostatic repulsion depends on the actual distance between the two electrons. So that's the actual vector difference between the two electrons, not the difference in their distances from the nuclei, which would be a lot easier to calculate. We actually need the vector difference. So if we're going to, the claim then, which is going to be justified in the next chapter, is that the expectation value of the interacting potential gives us an estimate as to how much the energies are going to change. So if I just put in my symmetric or anisymmetric wave function and take the expectation value of the interacting potential, I can learn how much the energies are going to change. And since the potential energy goes up when the electrons are close together, and the electrons are close together in a spatially symmetric state, we're expecting that the spatially symmetric states are going to have high energy, and the spatially antisymmetric states, where it's impossible for an electron to be at the same position as the other electron, aren't going to be as affected, won't be pushed up as much. So for this, we kind of have some online material where we actually go through and calculate these integrals. And we're doing it in the context of the excited states of helium. So the ground state of helium consists of both electrons in the same lowest energy state, which is n equals 1, l equals 0, m equals 0, the lowest available state. And since they're both in the same spatial state, they have to be in, and since it's the same state, it's symmetric, the spin state then has to be anisymmetric. So we're going to have one spin up, one spin down with a minus sign between them. If you remember your Clebsch-Gordan tree, that state is what you get when you add spin 1/2 to spin 1/2 and get spin 0. So spin 0 states are called singlet states because they're unique. Okay, so that's the ground state. Not super interested in the ground state. Let's take a look at the excited states. So for the excited state, we're going to have one electron in the ground state, the 1s state, and we're going to put the other electron in one of the n equals 2 states. So there are two n equals 2 states. There is a 2s state and a 2p state. So first of all, let's be a little bit careful about our nomenclature. I can't put electron 1 in the ground state and electron 2 in the excited state because they're indistinguishable particles. I have to actually have something that is anisymmetric under exchange. And if I separate out the spin variables from the spatial variables, with the spin variables, you know I can make something that is symmetric, say both spin up, or any one of the triplet states that come from adding spin 1/2 to spin 1/2 to get spin 1. So I can match that symmetric spin state with a spatially antisymmetric state, right? So that would overall be antisymmetric. Or I can take this spin state that is antisymmetric, that would be the singlet state, where we have up, down, minus, down, up. We could take that antisymmetric state and pair it with a symmetric spatial state. And in order to get an idea of how the energies are going to occur, all we need to do is to take the expectation value of 1 over the magnitude of the distance between the two electrons. Well, those actual integrals to do the expectation value are pretty ugly, but they're done online in h.06.html and h.07.html. And the results are not super accurate, but at least they're kind of qualitatively correct. And what we find is that the lowest order, lowest energy state comes from having the second electron in the 2s state, and of course having it in a triplet state, which means since it's symmetric in spin, it's antisymmetric in space. Antisymmetric in space means it's unlikely for the two electrons to be at the same location. So 1 over R1 minus R2 isn't as big as it would be otherwise, so it's not pushed up as much as it would be otherwise. So it turns out that according to this calculation, all of the triplet states are below all of the singlet states, and the precise numbers are sitting there in those websites. So we have lowest order states are triplet, where we have excited states, excited electron in either the 2s or the 2p. And then further up, we have singlet states where we have the electron in the 2s or the 2p respectively. So the p states always seem to have more energy than the s states, and the triplets always seem to have less energy than the singlet states. So the latter statement, that maximizing the spin is going to minimize the energy, we're going to announce that as one of Hund's rules. I mean, even though we've only talked about it for two electrons, we're going to happily apply it to multi-electron situations. And the reason we're going to do that is the logic that we've said. If we have the largest possible spin, then that means we have kind of the maximum amount of symmetry because we put the spins up as much as possible. And if we have lots of symmetry in the spin state, we can have lots of anti-symmetry in the spatial state. And anti-symmetry in the spatial state means the electrons don't get close to each other, which means there isn't as much repulsion, which means that the energy isn't pushed up as much as it would be otherwise. Okay, so Hund's rule number one proclaims that, among other things that we're going to do, we're going to want to maximize the spin in order to minimize the energy. High spin states are going to have low energy compared to low spin states. So the other thing we want to get at today has to do with what's called the L tilt. So if we're thinking about multi-electron atoms, we can think about an outer electron in particular. It's going to see a cloud of negative charge from those inner electrons surrounding a nucleus. And to a large extent, the negative charge on the electron cloud is going to cancel out the positive charge on the nucleus. The effective charge that that outer electron is going to see is going to be smaller than it would be otherwise. So what we really want to do, though, is look at how the shape of the orbit, the eccentricity of the orbit, how elliptical the orbit is of this outer electron, how that is going to affect the energy. So the first thing that affects the energy is the semi-major axis of an elliptical orbit, which is controlled by the principal quantum number. The next thing we want to look at is how squashed the orbit is, right? So remember from 191 or mechanics that the orbits of the planets, which are identical to the classical orbits of the electrons, are ellipses with the sun at a focus. We can have circular orbits, and circular orbits have lots of angular momentum. Or we can have orbits like comets that basically fall in from infinity and then go right back out. So since there's not a lot of orbit in a cometary orbit, it has a small amount of angular momentum. So the S states, the small L states, are the highly eccentric orbits that are like comets. They start far out from the nucleus, but they get very close to the nucleus. So such an orbit will experience the full electrostatic pull of the nucleus. It'll penetrate the cloud of the inner Mohr electrons. So as a result, the small L orbit is going to have, it's going to experience the strong positive force of the nucleus more, and so it's going to have a lower energy than the circular orbits, which are going to be by and large outside of the cloud of positive of negative charge. So we call this the L tilt, that if you look at all of, say, the n equals 3 levels, so that would be 3s, 3p, 3d, they're going to be ordered so that the S states are lower in energy than the D states. So the 3d states are circular orbits, well outside the cloud. The S states penetrate the cloud and as a result have lower energy. So this is going to play a role when we build up multi-electron atoms. So if we think about, it's usually called the Aufbau principle, we can add one electron at a time to these various orbitals, and we're going to put them first in the S, and then in the P, and then in the D, etc. So we'll talk about that next time.